Hello and welcome to the next 100 Days podcast. My name is Graham Arrowsmith.
And my name's Kevin Appleby. So today, Graham, we're revisiting kids' play, a subject we covered a couple of weeks ago. But Amanda, today's guest, is linking fun and learning into big brands.
That's interesting. I've overlapped a little bit in my career in this sort of general area. Today, your business, Amanda, is called Fundamentally Children.
Yeah,
Amanda
the capital
Gummer,
fun.
welcome to the next 100 Days podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we were just talking off air that basically I didn't know whether or not you're from Canada or not because it was some glitch on the website, but it seemed that you were from the UK. I'm so glad that you are, but you've got a quite distinct Northampton sort of accent. Are
Am I?
you? Yeah, I think you do actually. Are you from that area?
Yeah, I grew up in and around Northamptonshire, and I'm back living now in Brackley. So,
Well,
yeah,
there you are.
Northamptonshire.
Dear listener, before we started the recording, Graham asked Amanda where she was from. So now I think he's faking that he recognises a Northampton accent.
No, not at all. Amanda surrendered that information, but it was some, as I say, a glitch on the website that she's going to fix this afternoon anyway. So, but we're recording this on the hottest day so far of the year. So all the climate wusses will be telling us that we're all going to die in a minute. So, but not me. It's a really weird phenomenon that we have. It's called summer, and I saw this thing the other day, Kevin, where it said, "We've never had it like this before." And then below, there was a little picture of 1976. Now, you might not have been around in 1976, Amanda, but I was. I was in Blackpool, and it was a cracking summer. And as hot as it is now, but anyway, by and by. So,
My
Amanda.
memories of June 1976 are walking home from school and stopping at the newsagents, picking up a bag of newspapers to deliver,
All
and sort of
right.
sweltering, going around the houses delivering them.
Yeah, well, you would have had fun doing that. And I suppose if Amanda was there that time, she would have figured out how can I make this paper delivery round even more fun than it actually is. It must be a really terrible job that you've got trying to inject fun into workplaces.
Yeah, no, yeah, terrible. When I was little, I wanted to be an ice cream lady because I wanted a happy job. I thought being an ice cream lady and selling ice creams would make people happy. And I'm not doing ice creams, but playing and toys and games and fun is pretty much the same ethos, I think.
Is it? I mean, so okay. Your direct, if you like, your audience for this company is who? Who are they? Who do you address your services to?
So anybody making stuff for kids, so whether that's toys or digital games or TV content or playgrounds or policy and education, so anybody who wants to understand children better so that we can do better by them.
Well, that's boy. This could go anywhere, but basically, I declare my interest. Back in the 80s, I worked for Lego, and after a few years of doing reasonably well in their sales team, they said, "Would you join Lego Education?" Which became Lego Dacta. I don't know what it is now, but basically, it was
Back
so.
to Lego education again now.
Is it back to the right? Okay,
Yeah.
so I was part of that team, and I suppose the most fun part of that is that I had a couple of colleagues, and we all had to decide how world faces were going to look on the world figures that we put into schools. And there were some really quite sensitive things that you could do, because I mean, shall we say, the depth or the width of lips for one particular ethnic sort of variant was so sensitive, so you had to get it absolutely right, otherwise you'd be caricaturing, or on the other hand, you just wouldn't be representing them properly. So at that early stage, I mean, I've got to say the inside job was that we had fun, but I guess in a way it was kind of important. So is that the type of work, in a way, that you get involved in, not caricaturing but helping people understand why they should be I don't know, this way rather than that way for children?
Yeah, we do a lot of work on inclusion, diversity, accessibility, and all of those things to try and make sure that nobody gets stigmatized. And there's a big debate in the UK, has been going on for years now, but the sort of the blue and pink debate and whether, you know, the idea is that all kids should be able to play with whatever they want, without stigma. And I think, you know, the stuff around that, the stuff around making sure that children with additional needs have access to the same play opportunities as far as possible as everybody else. So there's quite a lot of research in that area. I think there should be more, but there is a lot of research and there's a growing knowledge bank. So I like the Maya Angelou quote, you know, do as well as you can with what you've got, and when you know better, do better. And we're adding to that knowledge base all the time. So my challenge to the companies that I work with is, well, we now know better, so come on, up your game.
How do you know that you know better?
Because the research, one of my main jobs is translating academic research into practical applied processes and policies and stuff, because that's why I left academia, was because I was upset that all of this amazing research was being done and was staying in the ivory towers of these universities, and actually the people who really needed access to the information
Yeah,
were
just
10
not getting
years
it.
plus behind and they weren't getting it. So it's not that I know better, it's that I have access to the research and can give that out to people to help them do better.
No, I wasn't really indicating that you knew better. I was just that how would you know that you were doing better? But it's because new research has been done.
Yeah.
But isn't it the case that research has, it's a bit like, statistics, you get statistics to tell you anything. Isn't research a
Tell me
bit
about
like
it.
that?
It can be, and that's why one of my favorite jobs is being the tire kicker on research papers.
Oh, you're missing
So,
Kevin. Kevin could do that for you.
oh, it sounds like a fantastic job, that one.
So I've done some work with the Children's Media Association in the States, and they compile research reports, but those research reports have been sent to them without any real sort of quality control. And so I interrogate them and make sure that the research stands up to scrutiny, really. And I think it's something that is informed the way we do research at Fundamentally Children, because there's a lovely quote by a German psychologist called Bronfenbrenner, and says that most of our understanding of child development comes from strange kids being watched by strangers in strange places doing strange things. And how the hell do you expect to be able to generalize to the wider population from that? So we turn that on its head, and all of our research is very much focused on observing children doing what kids do in familiar settings with people that they feel comfortable with, so that we can actually get data that's meaningful.
I've got to say, I really quite like what you're doing. I'm not sure
Thanks.
I'd like the outcomes of some of the things that you do, but that's because of who I am.
What
But
do you mean?
well, what I mean is that you talk about DEI. I don't believe in it, because I just don't believe that we need that. But that's just my view. I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm just saying that's my view, and I think there are other ways of looking at that. And we had a guest on probably about a year ago now, Kevin, and we had this very same debate, and she was pretty much of the same view. So effectively, there are other people out there who don't think that that's important. I just read somewhere that the first female Olympic committee head, first female head of that Olympic committee thing, said, "No, we're not having people who are claiming to be men who are not claiming to be women who are not men." Again, claiming to be women
I
who are
get
men,
it.
are banned from Olympic events. And I was like, when my wife looking at this, what do you think? A cheer. It's a cheer all round. Because for me, supporting girls and females in a fair way would exclude people who were came from a different body originally.
I think you're confusing two different issues. I think men and women's sport is one issue, and it's a very specific issue, and there's a biological reason why men shouldn't be in women's sport, and I completely agree with that. I think what when I talk about leveling the playing field for children who have difficult upbringings, additional challenges because they're disabled, a child who is in a wheelchair should be able to sit and play a game of Monopoly with his mates just like anybody else. The fact that
Absolutely.
there's not a ramp there, you know, I think
isn't it?
making play accessible for all children is good for the whole of society.
That's not DEI, is it? So basically, I mean, my wife and I went for a walk in a Bradford park last week, and we saw a young man who was clearly disabled, and he was being, I think it was something to do with the bike or whatever it was. He was experiencing play exactly as you were saying, and we were both really happy about the fact that he was being treated in this way, because it was putting him in exactly what you just said earlier. He was allowed to experience what it was like to be on a bike, or I can't remember the exact setting, but he was on a bike. So from my point of view, I think it's almost like having that safety net for all children in particular, so that they can experience these things. So I'm kind of a long way towards your point of view. It's just that some of the, shall we say, macro things that sometimes get in the way of policy. I wonder how you can possibly deal with that.
So I think, I mean, education, and I do a lot of work in the playground space, and making sure that kids can access playgrounds is really important. And it's not just about putting a wheelchair ramp in and a ground level roundabout. It's about making sure that there's some toilets and the car parking is suitable and all of that kind of stuff. So it's understanding it. And I think DEI as a term gets a bad rap because of things like the men in sport, women in sport, and some of the overly zealous applications of it. But the general principle is that nobody should be left behind and everybody should be given the opportunity to fulfill their potential. And I don't know anybody that would argue with that.
No, I think most people would agree with you. But I just, when I was a kid, my parents taught me that they believed in a safety net, and that didn't mean to say that, somebody was going to be, I don't know, put on a platform because they had special needs, but they would be looked after, because effectively you couldn't let people fall through. So there's almost a mental space in our head, in our family, that said, no, give them every chance to be successful. And I saw some of that when I was working with Lego, and I think from my point of view, that's what you're doing is good. But I don't know, I just worry sometimes that the macro or the political opinion and the ways in which the world works around you might influence how you are and the development of children in the spaces that you're at.
So I think that's one of the reasons I was really pleased to be part of the Play Commission last year, where we took a massive, well, it was a year-long project, and there were 20 odd, I think, commissioners, and I was one of them. And we were bringing evidence in, looking at how play works in education, in the digital world, in, toys and indoors, outdoors, everything. We did this massive review, and there's a really good report called "Raising the Nation." And it was supported by Paul Linley, who used to own a little founded Ella's Kitchen and then sold it and has become a philanthropist. And he just got a group of people together to hear evidence from people who were working on this. And it's been presented to government and it's been taken seriously. And there's quite a lot of the recommendations in that report are being implemented. So I think it depends on your view on politics and stuff, but I think there's a lot of people who are trying to do the right thing, and we need the evidence to be able to say this is what the right thing looks like. And you can't criticize people for not being as socially minded as they could be if they don't understand why it's important. And I think so. I think there's a lot of I think there is a lot of good being done, but I think there is a lot more to do, and I think it is important that we prioritize kids because they are the future, and they're the ones that are going to be in work when we're going to be leading, looking after at later date. So I think there's a, we need to make sure that they've got jobs and that they're well equipped for that. And I think play is such a powerful tool in giving kids those skills.
So Amanda, you're talking about the practicalities of studying kids as they're playing, watching them play. And I personally find that fascinating, having four small grandsons. I think watching those individuals play, not necessarily playing with them, but watching them play, seeing how they interact with stuff and seeing how they learn how it works and so on, I just find fascinating. And I think that must be a super job, being able to do that all the time.
Yeah, it is. And it's something that when we're talking to parents, they're just standing back and watching. Because I think parents feel under a lot of pressure to entertain their kids 24/7 and supervise and all that kind of stuff. And yes, you need to keep an eye on them, but actually taking that step back and letting the kids play. And you hear when you're standing, when you're just sort of coming by the bedroom door, or you're just sort of in the kitchen and they're playing in the lounge or something, and you hear the dialogue, whether it's kids or siblings or whatever, in that imaginative play, you get to understand so much about what's on their mind, what they're struggling with, what they're worried about, what they think about certain things, and what makes them laugh and stuff. It's such a powerful, powerful tool, and it's part my favorite part of my job.
I've got to say that I have an awful lot of interest in what you're doing, not least because I spent 4 years of my life supplying people with things that I was in shops and people would say that, I've had this. Oh, it's expensive, they'd say, first of all. Like, and then you say, well, how long have you had it? Oh, for 30 years. Well, not quite 30. It wasn't 30 years then. It came around in 1959 when I was born. But basically, they'd had it for years. So, back in the 80s, it maybe done what, 20, 30 years. And so basically it people really appreciated the ability. It's a new toy every day, that they create the ability to create with whatever they've got in front of them. For me, that was one of the things Allegro got right, I think, at the time, is that they didn't have brown bricks. Or green bricks. You probably know the story, but do you know why?
I don't actually.
Well, I've probably mentioned it to you, Kevin, but it was because at that time they were didn't want to have them because it would lead to war toys, or they would use them for, toys that were associated with war, and that's definitely it was against the Christiansen family, and they didn't want to do that. But along came, changes, and I'm sure it was for the best. But basically, they started to brand with people like Star Wars and so forth, and all of a sudden, you had, endless amounts of war type products, masquerading under the Lego brand, Lego brand. And so basically, I don't know. I just felt somehow they'd kind of lost some of their essence at that point. But if you're looking at toys, if you're looking at how can do you help specify what toys can be used by schools?
No, I mean, we have the Good Play Guide, and a lot of schools use that to find toys to help with particular skill development and everything. But I think the point you make about Lego, I think, is really interesting, and it goes back to your earlier point about how we're impacted by the time we live in. And when Lego was set up, it was Second World War was fresh in everybody's memory, and anything that was encouraging, or you could understand why they were reticent. And I think but the from a different point of view, taking away the brown and the green takes away opportunities to talk about nature and trees and greens, outdoor spaces. So I think it's good that that's been rectified.
There's always another way of looking at it, but I get what you're saying. I don't know. It was just one of those little things that I just remember at the time. But the effort that they put into making their toys, I don't know. My dad would have said straight with a church clock. So in other words, it was that kind of. They'd spent so much time making their toys. I don't want to say the wrong word here, but appropriate. So in other words, the kids recognize that, ah, oh, this is a black taught person, and they didn't worry that was the case. Although, oh, this is a Chinese looking person, that's okay, they're all friends because we're all in the same. My granddaughter has some new toys, and I noticed they're all said, what on earth are they? And they basically all had different sort of multicolored hair, and it was some kind of new set of dolls. And they look kind of really, I don't know, grunge or whatever, but that's what she wants. She's 8 years old. I mean, it was just horrific. I mean, they're all different colors. So I suppose from that point of view, there's a tick in the sort of diversity box. But the point is, they had stupid colored hair. And, what can I say, Kevin? I would have dyed it back to their natural color. But
Well, I
it's just
can't
a
agree. There's always a novelty toy about that's got something different.
probably sold really well, that toy, I've
I'll
got to say.
refer you back to Teletubbies and things like that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, having lived in the toy industry for so long, several years, and at Toy Fair we used to have royal visitation as well. Princess Diana used to come along with her mother and various other people to the show to have a look around the. She was only a kid at the time, but look around the the stall if you like. So I was very fond of the toy industry, but it's frighteningly competitive.
It is, yeah, no, it is, and I think that's one of the issues that I struggle with in the industry is the kind of the race to the bottom and the label slapping. So you've got a whether it's a Peppa Pig or a Star Wars or whatever, you've got that license, you slap it on a toy, and you don't actually put a lot of R&D time into making sure that the toy is going to be good for the kids and it's going to help them not learn always, but just help them develop and develop skills, whether it's communication or collaboration or, confidence or whatever it is. But toys should help children learn about the world in some way. And even if it's learning about themselves and what makes them happy, that's valuable. But just sort of the slapping stuff on and piling it high and selling it cheap, I think is just a way of getting the landfill quicker.
And I get that race to the bottom. The one thing that I used to dread was the Christmas Day latest Barbie toy appearing for daughter when she was little. Because you'd get it, you'd unwrap it, you'd have to construct it, and you'd realize very, very quickly it was the worst quality product ever devised by man. Now, it would break as fast as it would assemble. It was completely flimsy. It didn't actually do properly what it did on the tin. And I think an awful lot of branded kids' toys do just play on whatever the brand is without necessarily putting the quality in front of the kids that you'd expect.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a, I'm not going to get into naming and shaming companies that I think could do better, but I think, there is a, I'm hoping there is a move in the industry towards a slightly more sustainability. But part of that is making better toys that last. And commercially, that, we're on a bit of a difficult one because in order to make money, you have to sell toys and you have to get the kids to buy more toys and, the following month buy another toy and that, so the collectibles and all that kind of stuff is what drives profits. But actually, if we're trying to take a more responsible approach, but making toys that last, making toys that can be played with repeatedly by lots of kids, Lego gets stuck at the loft and then handed down to the next generation because it's got that longevity. And there are other brands that do that too. But the more we can do of that, the better I think we are for our kids. But it's at odds with the commercial realities of business today. So I don't know how you square that circle.
Yeah, and that really is where Lego stands out. And there's a box of Lego up in our playroom that grandchildren get out, and it's a combination largely of stuff that our kids had and stuff that I had. So there's bits of Lego in that box that are 60 years old.
Lego bricks, but no, I we used to have to spell Lego with capitals, for branding and for legal purposes and so forth. So woe betide you if you didn't. If you put a lowercase LEGO, or if you were dyslexic and put two G's, you probably were describing a brand from the Far East. So the lawyers would go out there and slap them. So, but that was the world then. But you, what you can do with your knowledge of translating toys and experiences and so forth into fun and direction for children. When you go back into those manufacturers, they'll say, "Oh, thank goodness shut your ear, Amanda. We haven't thought of that."
No, so I think again, this is the battle I have sometimes. Some of them are like, we just can't afford it. We don't, we need to make the cheap plastic stuff because that's what sells. And part of my mission, I guess, with Fundamentally Children, a Good Play Guide, is to make doing the right thing by kids and investing in that sort of child-centered approach more profitable because I want the people who do the right thing by kids to be the ones who make the money. I want to live in a world where you don't have to choose between, being vocational or being moral and being rich. I think why can't we do both?
Well, it'd be interesting to know if you had any real examples of anybody that sort of stepped up in in that area, because I'm struggling at the moment to think through. I mean, there are some brands that have always been like that. We've mentioned at least one of them, But there are others as well, and you'll know their names. But has your intervention helped change marketing path so that they basically
I would
recognize
like
that?
to think so, yes. So I think we've got a couple of really nice testimonials from clients who said, oh, we've seen the impact of a Good Play Guide accreditation on sales. And some research that we've done for Tony's is a great company on a massive trajectory of growth. And we did some impact measurement research for them to make sure that, they wanted to check that what they thought was happening and all the rest of it. And that has helped, I think, fuel that growth for them. So I think there's also the de-risking element. If you do the research early on, I can tell you a couple of examples where we've saved money because we've de-risked it. So there was it was a Thomas the Tank Engine range of toys, and they're cute, really beautiful wooden toys. And one of them was one of those hammer and peg things where you back very old traditional play pattern, but the holes were too big and the pegs kept dropping through. So during the play testing, we were able to do all the play. I mean, it should have been picked up by the factory quality assurance, but because we were doing the play testing, we were seeing how frustrated the kids were getting. We were able to give that information back to the company. They pulled that one from the range and launched with five instead of six products. But so much better that they did that than launch with six and get the bad PR and feedback because one of them wasn't up to scratch. And then the other one was a Daily Mail headline with a toy train going, toy train makes kid bald. And it was a kid motorized toy train that a kid had put in his hair and pressed on, and the wheels had gone round and pulled the hair out. And because we tested it in the Good Play Guide, we were able to go back to the press and say, look, this is a good toy. It's Do we really need to live in a world where you have to put may contain nuts on a bag of peanuts? No, the kid shouldn't have been putting it in its hair. Nowhere in the guideline does it say that this train is suitable to be run all over your body. This is just one of those kids' accidents. It's not the toy's fault. And that damage limitation was really valuable to the brand because, it's important that you don't get accused of hurting kids when you're a toy manufacturer.
Yeah, sounds like something I could do with for my hair, really, I suppose. But keep me close shaven. I'm getting one of those things tomorrow, Kevin. It's coming in the post tomorrow. I think Royal Mail are delivering it. And it's one of those that you can do it yourself. Because for the last God knows how many years, we've used a Remington, which cost us £18.75. And it's about, I don't know, 30 years ago. So but I've had 30 years of not spending money down at the barber. And I know you do, Kevin, because that barber comes in one of those big trucks to your village.
It's Mobile Barber. It's
Mobile
fantastic.
barber. But all I can say, I have this question for you. I was listening earlier, and the one thing that came into my mind was I would call it initial customer profile or ICP. Some people call it ideal customer profile. And with the sort of things that I get involved in, the sort of marketing platform that I'm involved in, we heavily look at the way in which a marketer, toy marketer, whatever, is looking at the people for whom their product is aimed at. It seems to me that you've got this wonderful positioning that you're just hovering above all these children where you can test market God knows how many clients. So why aren't they beating a path to your door to test every single product? You know them probably as because then you have that sort of dissonance between what they're expecting the response to be and what actually it is. And so there's a development plus a positioning thing that they can get right, that instead of using this word to describe its function, use this word and you'll get more sales.
Yeah, so why they're not beat as well? Some of them, there's a lot of expertise around, people have been in the toy industry for a long time, and there is a lot of expertise, and people in the companies may have done their own research or may feel like they've been doing this long enough to be able to make a call on it. And it often comes down to cost. But we do a lot of that kind of research. So we did one for a kids' TV show, and it was a load of motorbikes, and there was a post bike, a kind of a Harley Davidson type, and all different types of bikes. And these bikes were friends. It was, I think, it was in the response to the Cars movie when that came out. They were like, vehicles work. Let's do something else. So they did these bike ones. And we did some audience research there to say, okay, what is it? They wanted to make sure that the kids engage with the characters and, you know, the themes of friendship and stuff were running through it. And we did some research and we found out which one the kids liked best. And was it because it was red? Was it because he was the kind of the, you know, the cheeky chappy? No, it was because he was the pizza delivery boy. And the kids were focused in on the pizza. And so that piece of information was really valuable to the client who was then rolling out the licensing strategy to go, okay, well, let's go lean into that rather than the theme of friendship or whatever it was they were thinking of doing. So we do quite a lot of that for brands in their development so that they can inform their licensing strategy.
Just sharpen up their marketing, because at the end of the day, I mean, if they've missed that, then I mean, they're missing all kinds of ways in which they could actually re-engineer their packaging and so forth. So, and the
Yeah.
what it's called, promotion, the whole thing.
Here's an interesting one, Graham. You're talking ICP. Who is the customer here? Because you could argue in one fold that it's the child, you could f argue in another that it's the parent.
Yeah, so for fundamentally children, our ICP are the toy or the kids' brands. They're the but yes, we have our B2B to C kind of model with Good Play Guide.
I think you're right. It's a really good question, Kevin. But I think the parents are generally speaking in an approver sort of position, that they basically, all right, okay, I'll give in. And so or they're listening to the children for cues about what they're interested in for Christmas or their birthday or whatever, or present for Easter, whatever it's going to be. But I don't know whether or not the toy companies themselves are really marketing towards the parents. Now, I spent an awful lot of time in shop windows setting up displays that would attract children and their parents to go into a store to have a look at Lego, and or the range of Lego services. But it's just one of the, how they used to glue these things. And it was really good when I used to go out there in the morning and driving from one part of the country to another, and next to me is a Lego model, and people were swerving to avoid me. It was quite interesting to see. But you're doing, what's the goal for your company? What is the thing that you get together as a team and you say, this is what we want to achieve?
I mean, from a personal point of view, I want play to be given the recognition that it deserves in education, in policy making, in the toy industry, in the digital space. I think understanding the power of play in children's lives, I think is one of the biggest things that we could do to change the world for the better.
Would you start education later, like is it the Germans do?
The Scandinavians do.
Scandinavia.
Yeah. So I would incorporate more play right through. So I think I think starting formal education later is no bad thing, but I think helping children learn through play can start really early on.
I would probably change it by a year or so, just to prove the point, and then move it a bit more radical. But I would definitely do that. I think there's a socialization thing that goes on. There's so much you'll learn anyway through play, as you quite rightly point out. But I would, it's this idea of going to school when you're five, and or actually four and a half, and effectively from that moment on, you're learning all kinds of things that will be helpful to you, but somehow it's almost like you're ebbing away the child's youth.
Yeah, and I think in today's world where, and I was having a really interesting conversation about this earlier, where knowledge now, access to knowledge is very much democratized because you can go online and you can find your answers to everything. So that kind of expert teacher giving information, imparting their knowledge to a child is very different. And actually, the skills we need to be teaching children now are critical thinking, you know, self-reliance, social skills. And some of the stuff that isn't part of the traditional curriculum. So I think it's really important that we prioritize play because it's a great vehicle for teaching some of those skills.
Yeah, you can deconstruct what they need by incorporating that into play. So is this a rich new scene for you in terms of the way in which potentially policy might swing?
I'm ever optimistic. Yeah, I think we've got a long way to go, and I think there's a lot more research needed into things like AI and digital methods of teaching and how kids can use the internet effectively, and the different types of learning. Because there's some research at the moment that I'm looking at about the difference between learning to read in a book versus learning to read on an e-reader, and also the writing. If you're writing, if you're revising notes and you're typing on a laptop versus if you're handwriting, though the kind of the neurological processes are different. And what does that do to your brain and your ability to make sense of what it is that you're learning? So I think there's all those kind of that research really needs to be robust and validated before we make policies on the back of it.
Well, I don't mind you, Kevin, but I'm learning an awful lot about the kind of structure of education and how play's got to evolve or got to be used more. What's the biggest barrier that you face, Amanda? What's the single biggest barrier that you face to achieving fundamentally children's goals?
That is a really good question. I think probably it's recognition or understanding of the importance of play. I think there is still a lot of people that feel that play is something that's frivolous, that is what kids do when they're little and doesn't. And I think and there's a I think if we could get that higher up the agenda on the political discourse, because if you think about it, play has an impact on education, health, communities. You know, all of those areas would see the government spending reduce if we get play right, youth justice, all of that. And so I think, you know, those kind of getting that recognition for the importance of play, I think would be my biggest barrier that if I could knock it down, I would.
Amanda, we've talked a lot about kids benefiting from better play and learning through play. Is there a lesson to take forward actually into adults and say that we try to force adults to learn the wrong way? Now you watch a child learn to walk. They learn because they manage to fail so many times. Yet as an adult, failure is brainwashed into us as a bad thing.
100% agree. Yeah, and I don't think you're ever too. What's there's Oh, I never remember who it is. You don't stop playing because you grow old. You grow old because you stop playing. And I think there's definitely something in that. I wish I'd remembered who said that. But yes, I think the whole and games for the elderly that stave off dementia and all of that kind of stuff. I think that's there is a whole environment or an ecosystem around play that. It's just fabulous and it's fun and it's enjoyable. And I think so many of the stuff that we do for, parents, you've got to go on a parenting education class, kids, you've got to go to a, special intervention for this or whatever. And it's all stigmatized and it feels dreary and it feels like a chore. Plays none of those things. And it is good for you. It's like, it's like finding the favorite vegetable that you just want to eat because you enjoy it rather than being forced to. Because your parents tell you you've got to eat your greens. It's I don't know why there's such a resistance to all of the good stuff that play brings.
One of the things that you do as a picture, I think you're at the top of the table there, and it's a workshop, and the table looks really messy. There's loads of stuff on it, the thing is, you say upskill your team with bespoke, engaging workshops to increase collaboration and ensure all members of your team are on the same page. Isn't that dangerous?
Why?
Don't. Isn't the nature of teams that you succeed because they have different points of view?
Ah, so there's a difference because the being able to collaborate and on for that particular workshop or those particular workshops, it's about giving everybody the same knowledge. So we do those workshops for people like publishers, where we get the editors, the commissioners, the sales team, the marketing team all in together and give them a framework of aging stages of child development so that they can be cohesive and they've all got the same base knowledge that they can then apply their skills to. So that's what we mean about being on the same page. And where there's evidence around child development and play, it's not a question of bringing lots of different opinions. It's about here's the evidence. Let's share it with you all so that you've all empowered to make informed decisions about how you do your job.
In the world of influencing education, are there other people who have a pretty opposite view to you that you think they're the devil, they're the devil, don't you talk to them? But are they actually influencing the development of children in the way in which they might like? I mean, I've in not in our country particularly, but some parents are dragging their children out of school because of the way in which they're being taught.
So I've not come across anybody in this space working with, in the kids space research, child development education that I fundamentally disagree with and on everything. I am probably fairly boringly in the middle. I take a fairly moderate view on most things because I do believe balance is the answer, and we have our balance play diet that we talk about a lot. And I think moderation in everything, and I don't believe in banning too many things if you don't need to. So I think, empowering kids and giving kids opportunities to fail and to try and to thrive is really important. So there isn't anybody that I butt heads with on a regular basis. No, I think there are people who take a slightly more, what's the word? A slightly firmer view on certain things, and I might take a slightly firmer view on things, but I don't normally struggle to find middle ground with most people.
That's because of you, though, Amanda. That's because you listen, but you'll also accept and debate a point of view. That's your nature, isn't it?
That's very kind of you to say so. I hope so. That would be nice.
Well, I've spotted that, Kevin. I'm sure you have as well, Kevin. He's the quiet one there, taking notes.
Definitely, definitely. But I have got that killer question. It says, Amanda, a lot of what you're talking about here is research, applying the research. Okay, you've stepped out of academia to try and get this stuff into practice. But what I'm struggling with a little bit is, how's your business model funded? Where's the money come from?
So it comes from companies who want us to do research to help them make better toys or better content for kids. Or so, yeah, most of our funding comes from corporates in the kids space.
Right.
The government don't throw you a bone as well, did they? Or is it just
We got Innovate UK funding to develop the Children's Digital Wellbeing Framework, but we applied for that through the grant and everything. So we haven't had government funding other than that.
That's not specific to you. I mean, I could apply for that as well. So, but so
Yeah.
yeah. So, but that's impressive, though. And how long have you been going?
We set the business up in 2012, but I've been doing research into kids and play for a lot longer than that.
Are you bored of it by now? Crikey, that's a long time.
No, it's fun.
That's a great answer, isn't it? It's fundamentally children. You shouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Amanda, forgive sometimes the direct question, but this is a really interesting area, and many of our listeners will have a view about the classrooms and the way in which their children are being taught, and maybe in which direction are they being taught, and how teachers are being taught to teach children. And you've handled that. I haven't even got to the rub of it, but basically, you've handled the questions really well.
Thank you.
So, on that bombshell, not quite a bombshell, but on that point, I'd just like to say, Amanda Gummer, you have been a first-class guest on the Next 100 Days podcast. Thank you.
Graham, after doing a podcast a couple of weeks ago talking about how do you make play accessible for kids? I think really interesting to learn a little bit more about the academic side of play and learning.
You've said it before that often we get streaks with a similar kind of topic. And I think Amanda is so well steeped in the, she said, she interprets the latest research into play in various settings, whether that's online or in school or whatever. And I think that ability, I think, is I've got the suspicion that it's underutilized, not necessarily because of any lack of ability on Amanda's part, but because of my lack of foresight on other people's part.
I think so, but I think the following that sort of early education one through is a an interesting subject, and certainly as I'm watching grandsons starting school, a lot of going to school is play anyway, very play oriented. But I do think there's a point where we kind of try to switch one side of the brain off and the other side of the brain on in education. I've never been convinced that that's quite the right thing to do.
Well, on our side of the family, we've on Don's side of the family, we've been involved with preschool for 30 years, and so some of the things, some of the people came first time round are bringing their children, and not quite grandchildren yet, but basically certainly children. So it's quite odd that people come through a village and went to the school and then preschool and then went on to other things and now brought their kids back. She and the people that she works with have seen so many changes and observes the way in which people play. But there is an their function is play. That's what they're doing. But they're so young when they start. And we're talking about 2 to 3 year olds. It's just so they do get some exposure to play, quite a lot of exposure to play, before they go to, the first, I can't remember what it's called, the first induction at big school. And then you've got from five on, they're going with their uniforms on and God knows what. Even though they might still be playing, they're not quite playing as at the same level as they were before.
Now, some of that to the kids is, oh, I'm growing up. I'm being a big boy or a big girl because
Yeah,
I've got the
all right.
uniform now, which is it's kind of badge of honor, but which I think you've got to do. You've got to recognize the maturing, the growing up, and the achievement part of this.
Another interesting podcast, Kevin. So thank you to Amanda for joining us. And today I've been Graham Arrowsmith.
I've been Kevin Appleby. Goodbye.
Goodbye.